the limelight.
A report finds extreme weather has killed more than 2 million people and cost $3.64 trillion in economic damages since 1970. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jenna Maguire, journalist. This article is published under the heading Climate-Driven Weather Disasters Increased Fivefold Over Past 50 Years, UN Agency says. Please stay tuned for the details of this article. The number of extreme weather disasters driven by the climate crisis has increased fivefold over the past 50 years, killing more than 2 million people and costing $3.64 trillion in total losses, a United Nations agency said recently. The World Meteorological Organization, WMO, says its Atlas report is the most comprehensive review of mortality and economic losses from extreme climate and weather incidents ever produced. It surveyed some 11,000 events between 1970 and 2019. The report highlights major catastrophes such as Ethiopia's 1983 drought, the single most fatal event with 300,000 deaths, and Hurricane Katrina in 2005, which was the most economically costly with losses of $163.6 billion. The report finds that from 1970 to 2019, weather, climate, and water hazards accounted for 50% of all disasters, 45% of all reported deaths, and 74% of all reported economic losses. The number of weather, climate, and water extremes are increasing and will become more frequent and severe in many parts of the world as a result of climate change, said WMO Secretary General Petteri Talas, adding, "That means more heat waves, droughts, and forest fires such as those we have observed recently in Europe and North America. We have more water vapor in the atmosphere, which is exacerbating extreme rainfall and deadly flooding. The warming of the oceans has affected the frequency and area of existence of the most intense tropical storms." The report finds that more than 91% of the 2 million deaths occurred in developing countries where there is weaker infrastructure and warning systems. The leading cause of death was drought, followed by storms, floods, and extreme temperatures. While deaths from extreme weather events have decreased almost threefold from 1970 to 2019 due to improved disaster reporting, economic losses are rapidly skyrocketing. According to the report, economic losses have increased sevenfold, surging from $175.4 billion in 1970s to $1.38 trillion in 2010s. An average of $220 million in damage occurred every day from 1970 to 2019. Storms being the most prevalent cause of damage, resulting in the largest economic losses around the globe. Three of the costliest 10 disasters occurred in 2017. Hurricanes Harvey, $96.9 billion. Maria, $69.4 billion. And Irma, $58.2 billion. The The report reveals crucial lessons from the past 50 years and makes a number of recommendations to governments, including review hazard exposure and vulnerability considering a changing climate to reflect that tropical cyclones may have different tracks, intensity, and speed than in the past. Strengthen disaster risk financing mechanism at national to international levels, especially for least developed countries and small island developing states and territories, and develop integrated and proactive policies on slow onset disasters such as drought. More lives are being saved thanks to early warning systems, but it is also true that the number of people exposed to disaster risk is increasing due to population growth in hazard-exposed areas and the growing intensity and frequency of weather events, said Mami Mistori, Special Representative of the Secretary General for Disaster Risk Reduction and Head of UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction. More international cooperation is needed to tackle the chronic problem of huge numbers of people being displaced each year by floods, storms, and drought, Missouri added, saying, "We need greater investments in comprehensive disaster risk management, ensuring that climate change adaptation is integrated in national and local disaster risk reduction strategies."
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the exalted, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, changed all our tomorrows. The program is dedicated and devoted to the life of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. We're discussing some very interesting points with my guest, Dr. Hassani, on, you know, why aren't there more Imam Khomeinis? Of course, Islam came to perfect humanity. And there's one very interesting aspect which really is a phenomenon not understood from a materialistic point of view, and I myself personally am witness to this. I didn't know anything about this great man. I never understood anything about this great man. I didn't know one iota of where this man was born.
I hate to say you to this. I have to admit it. We still don't know about so many
important
things.
Thank you for that, Doctor. I don't wish to
and
make...
I don't just say that to be humble. Or
no. We are we genuinely mean that. Because, yes, as I say, even to this day, why are we having these programs? Because we want to go into depth about a man that perhaps we still know very little or nothing about. But the thing that I wanted to point out was that I was 16 at the time, and the first impact that this gentleman made on me... As a teenager, was that I was reminded of prophets in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't come really from an Islamic background. I came from a more or less a Christian background. And I was impressed by the fact that this is the first time in the 20th century, or in a long time, for many generations, that's the first time I've seen a personality that really, really reminded me both of Allah and of his prophets. But the most important thing I felt was love. I felt I had to know this man. I felt I had to leave my home country 4,500 miles away. I may be exaggerating the distance. I don't know. It may be 5,000 miles. It depends on your flight and how you get to Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I had to come here. I had to come to the very land, the very country in which this man was born, to find out what was this thing that he placed into my soul, into my heart, that made me love him. Can you explain something about that for me, Dr.
Yes,
Husni?
Honesty.
Honesty.
His honesty.
Honesty with Allah subhanahu
let's,
wa ta'ala.
Let's not get sophisticated, complicated.
Sure.
Let's not get entangled with words.
Sure.
He was honest. Ask me with whom.
With whom, yeah.
With himself first.
Exactly.
He knew himself.
And if you know yourself, you know your creator.
And if you know yourself, you know your creator.
Creator.
There's a hadith.
Yes, that's right.
Man arafa nafsa.
Please quote it.
Faqad arafa rabba. But I have to make a point about this.
Please.
Very important and significant tradition. Because the thing is that unfortunately, I say this with the bottom of my heart, as a Muslims, we have all the values, the sources, the true sources of knowing and enjoying the beautiful life that God gave us. But we don't use it to the level. All the traditions, all the, you know, the Quranic verses, we only get a piece of it, maybe the beginning, we forget about the end, or vice versa. And we don't think about that.
Well,
brother, the only difference between us, just like I mentioned in the other program, and different creation, different creatures, is the power of thinking in a true sense. This is why Quran, talking about fake, talking about aql, talking about tadabbur, which is different level of thinking.
Thinking.
In order to think, you have to become quiet first.
Yes.
You have to become silent. We have a tradition to
mention this. That's right.
How can you learn? How can you listen to something if you always talk?
Exactly.
You have to find an isolate place with yourself, which is within yourself, actually. We're not talking about only material here.
No.
We're not talking about the physical aspect of being alone. You can be in a gathered, but being alone. Thinking about your own stuff. And you can be alone, but working with the universe, working with the creation.
Could I just throw something at you, just right there and then, that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, mentions that if you are in silence, as the silence that you refer to, which is a silence in which to acquire wisdom, do it for 40 days, and it will pour out of you. In other words, we're not alone.
No, we're not.
You're alone with your creator.
Exactly.
Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, I wanted to quote this from the Bible.
And if you are alone with your creator, you are everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing about the prophets, that I used to read about them in the Bible, that Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, used to go away for 40 days and 40 nights, as it's quoted in the Bible, alone in the desert. For what? I mean, that's something that, you know, the Christians don't come back with.
As they say, something to think about.
Something to think about. Exactly. And
back
he went to do
tradition.
His thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where he poured out as the master, the teacher. When he came back to Jerusalem after those 40 days, that was the wisdom that was being quoted in the book.
He was a different person.
He was a totally different person.
He got the vision.
He got the vision.
When you get, brother, when you get the vision, you get the mission. Imam is somebody with special, unique, divine mission. Back to the tradition. Man arafa nafsa.
Yes.
Those who get to know themselves, their true sense, which is soul, faqad arafa rabba, most surely they get to know their Lord, their sustainer, who happens to be a creator.
Exactly.
The point about this very significant tradition is this. This tradition is not talking about something about impossible, because when you're talking about God, you say, oh, you cannot get to know him, because he's infinite. How can a finite phenomena thing, material, whatever.
Well, this is what philosophers come up with, isn't it?
Yeah, we're not trying to get philosophical
about it. Yeah. No.
This is not the point of this program.
No.
I'm trying to explain it as simple as possible. This is another, if you want to mention it down,
we'll do that. We'll do
Imam
that.
Khomeini was simple in a true sense. Yeah. The same way that Quran is simple. Quran talks to an ordinary person, because Quran is, by the way, is the book of guidance. Wants to take you from A to B without any damage.
Any damage. Without any... Yeah.
And at the same time, talking to ordinary person, but yet talking to the philosopher, to the historian, to whoever can understand a different level,
exactly.
A deeper one.
Yes.
The point about this tradition, you're not talking about something impossible. Because if you get to know yourself, you get to know your sustainer. So the point about it is this. How are you going to get to know yourself? Think about it. I make it simple for you. I'm a weak person. If I know my weakness, the opposite of it, which is not weakness, which is power, which is total might, okay? God Almighty, we say, we claim. You get to know the power of Allah. If you get to know the power of Allah, you are not going to be scared. As simple as that, I put it. If you're not scared of something, so what? You take steps to do things. You're not scared. You can be. You can take risk. You can be brave enough to take action. Nobody, you know, if they threaten you with sanction, or they say, as they say, this is a joke. Everything, all the options on the table.
All
this is another program.
Yeah,
you know, we talk
right.
about
yeah,
this
all options on the table.
On
the
Islamic
really
awakening and ethical freedom.
They don't have anything on the
they
table.
Not, I mean, if you have something concrete, if you have something solid, you know, you don't constantly threaten somebody with it. You just do it.
You just do it.
You just come out and do it.
Exactly. I mean, that's...
Well, they do. The thing is that they forget that our option is on the table at the same time.
That's right.
And our option is something way, way different than theirs, which is, we're talking about God here. Somebody you can rely on, somebody you can trust, and somebody who can do anything possible. So if you get to know yourself with weakness, you get to know him with great power. If you get to know yourself with lack of knowledge, you have to open a parenthesis, you know, to remember, then close the parenthesis.
Yes.
If you get to know yourself that you don't have the knowledge of everything, then you know your sustainer knows everything.
Everything.
And now Alim, he's the most knowledgeable one. Brother, all these words, this is not words. This is a reality.
That's right. I mean,
when you say God is Sami, it doesn't mean something that, you know, you think about material. God is not material.
No.
It means that he can hear everything.
Yeah.
He created everything.
To get back to the, you know,
to get to the point
that about Imam's personality. And
Imam, I started with saying he was honest.
Right. I want to get to that point. That honesty that created that love in my heart.
And he was
heart.
Honest about himself. Let's not forget that.
Yeah. I mean, that honesty that, as you quite rightly say, about himself, again triggered or made us rejuvenated about something we had forgotten.
It started our engine, our motor.
Exactly. And that motor was not that it was the love of Imam, but it was to...
Very good point. You love Imam because of something else.
Yeah, exactly, because it had brought
again,
you back
credit,
to your creator.
The credit goes to somebody else.
Because you're reminded...
Let's not forget, it doesn't mean that we don't appreciate things. No. It doesn't mean like that.
No.
Because we have a tradition again. Man lam yashkur al makhluq, lam yashkur al khaliq. Those who don't appreciate the creation of God, most surely they don't appreciate the creator. This is an obvious thing.
Yeah.
We're not going to challenge
that. And as you say, that simplicity, that honesty, really
simplicity, I have to emphasize, I have to underline.
Yeah.
In a true sense.
Yes.
Because when you say something simple, remember when Imam was coming back from Paris after 15 years in
exile?
That's right.
Yes.
He's in the plane sitting, you know.
Yeah.
Relaxing.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, we look through the window of the plane. This journalist,
John Simpson,
whoever, ask him, what is your feeling? He says nothing. You know how many wrong interpretation they took out of this?
Oh, yes.
Let me explain that. When he said nothing, it means that I don't submit myself to some particular thing that if it changes, I would become ballistic about it. Think about what I just said.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything happens, hey, what is your feeling after 15 years or whatever? Returning to your homeland. Nothing. Because I'm thinking about God. God is all the feeling.
Exactly.
God is all the mean. God is all the goal. You see, you get my point?
Well, that's exactly what we want to get to. That this beautiful personality was reminding us, because he, for the 20th century, became not the Imam of the Islamic Republic of Iran, but he became the representative for us.
By the way, he was Iranian. Only Iranian should love him.
Exactly. That's what I'm getting to.
He was Muslim. Only Muslim should love him.
But let me finish my point.
But that's not the case.
Please,
I'm listening.
Because the letter that went to John Paul II, the Pope of the second biggest...
That's a different story.
But we'll get to that. But the Pope the leader of the second most dominant religious grouping, if you like, in the world, Catholicism. He writes a letter to them, and even the Pope has to be reminded that he's supposed to be representing God on earth.
That he should have a divine mission.
A divine mission.
Don't
that he should
it.
Have a divine mission.
Exactly.
And because the love that Imam Khomeini brought for so many people throughout the world.
True love.
Was the love of the reminder of the Creator.
Creator. This is the whole point.
And that's what we're
getting
to. And
we can go on forever.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's the perfection we are looking for.
Exactly. Where are you coming from? Mm. Where you are in? What the situation? Mm. What is the situation? And where are you going to?
So, Dr. Hasni, give us the manual now from the Imam's personality.
This is a good word, manual.
Yeah, the manual from the Imam's personality.
I like that.
Give us it in terms of that perfection. Because, of course, he's written books on this subject.
The reason I'm saying that, brother, because, you know, I'm listening to the words you're using. Mm. This one was a good one.
Yeah.
Brother, because I see Quran as a manual for humankind.
Yeah.
You know, just like, you know, I can give you another example. A factory which makes whatever,
yeah,
appliances,
sure,
you know, electronics, whatever. Let's say Sony and Sanyo, okay? They
yeah.
make these TVs and whatever.
Yeah.
For every device, mm-hmm. they print a particular manual.
Yeah.
And no two factories makes a manual for a different one. Okay.
That's right.
Quran is a manual.
Yeah, Sony won't build for
and
JVC,
vice versa.
JVC or Sanyo.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Imam Khomeini's manual is learning Quran, get to know God, and follow the path.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه.
But we want to get back to this love aspect of Imam Khomeini. Who puts that love there?
God.
Why?
Why? Because there is a holy tradition.
Mm.
There is a hadith of Qudsi.
Holy tradition. There's nothing complicated about this.
No, I make it simple for you.
Right.
I read it. Mm. I translate it. I'm trying to explain it. Mm. Okay? Mm. Then we understand. God says to his holy prophet in a holy tradition. It says, "Kunto kanzan makhfiyan." God talking about himself.
Right.
I was a hidden treasure.
Treasure, yes. From Hadith Qudsi, yes.
Fa'ahbabto. I love to. I like to.
Mm.
To be
known.
To be recognized. As simple as that. Love comes from Allah.
But it's important because in the
English... if it wasn't for love, if it wasn't for likeness, okay, there is no reason to live. Because we're not solid.
Sure.
We're not rock. Mm. We have to have certain feelings.
I think for our listeners, we have to mention the point here that the Arabic is much more sophisticated than just saying in
and
English.
And it takes time to explain.
Yeah,
it.
Just to say that he wanted to be known, that's not because of a need.
He loved to. He liked to.
Yeah, it's because of the fact that, you know, he has the power to bring things into existence.
And
that existence is the perfection of that Creator.
Exactly.
So that is the point we want to make here. That this
and this is a favor he gave us.
This is a favor.
This is a favor.
That's it. Thank you for that. And I wanted to get back to that point that you mentioned before about knowing Quran, because Imam Khomeini says in that Hukumat Islami, he says Quran was being recited by beautiful singers and parrot fashion.
Mm-hmm.
1400 years, what's going on? Why parrot fashion? Why does Imam make such a claim in his book? Because at the end of the day, not knowing this book has been the problem. That has been the source of our troubles for the last 1400 years, and he brought back the true reading of the Quran. Even he's pointed out the fact that those schools of thought that claimed to know something about the Quran were erroneous in what they were doing,
and
because of the fact that they didn't have the key the key that was needed to take us towards that perfection.
The main key.
The main key.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm talking about.
When you talk about Quran, again, we're not talking about something, you know, we're not fantasizing.
Yeah, we're not fantasizing.
We have it. It's available.
Yeah.
You know, this is an example I give you sometimes.
Yeah.
We don't appreciate Quran. You know why?
No.
Because they send us to us free. It was sent to us free. Yes. We don't appreciate it. Anything free, just like, you know, we pollute the air. Yes. We don't pay for it.
We don't pay for it.
Okay?
But if we had to pay for it.
Having said that, having said that, I give you another example.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if this particular copy of Quran was the very last Quran on earth and it was hidden in somewhere that you don't know?
Yeah.
How much you would pay to get back it, to get back to it?
Or, no.
Have you ever thought about this?
Let's go into that. Let's go into that analogy. That's a very beautiful point you're picking up there. Again, you know, as you say, we don't give the value that needs to be, that deserves to be given. I mean, this has been a problem throughout our Muslim history. And I call it a black Muslim history. I'm sorry I use that word. But I have no option but to use this word. And the reason being...
And you're not trying to be pessimistic about this.
No, I'm not pessimistic.
I'm
simply using that word in the sense that we had valuable personalities.
Because here we're trying to realize the difficulties and throw a solution.
Yeah, these treasures, like Imam Ali, that the Holy Prophet refers to as the gate of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we threw it away.
And who is the key? Imam.
Imam. We threw it away in Karbala. They were riding horses over the holy personality of Imam Hussein. That was That's a difficult thing for me to say. But the thing is that is the thing, as you quite rightly say, that is the price of this book that we don't appreciate. And this man says that whatever I have brought it to you from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And I'd like to...
From the movement of Ashura. This is one of...
Yeah, an important build-up in the personality of the Imam. I'd like to go into that tradition, that why this plays such an important part in the personality of the Imam, hopefully in the next session. But definitely this is a subject we need to speak about. But this simplicity, please tell us, Dr. Hasni, about how simple it... Because you lived in those times. How simple was Imam... Because I remember you mentioned to me in a conversation that, you know, he was speaking to the people, the bakers. He was talking about power politics to the bakers.
When he said the famous statement that American administration, cannot do a damn thing.
Mm.
He said it in a gathering with the Qomis bakers at the time.
That's the people of the city of Qom.
This is how... Mm. How respectful he was toward every single person. He didn't see him as something different. He said, I respect you because God created you. God put you on earth. And God put some certain connection between us. All the relationship that we should or we're supposed to have with each other.
Quite. And that's true Islamic values.
Ask me how he got it from.
Yeah, where he got it from.
From Quran.
Yes.
Again.
Again,
Quran talks, you know, he said God is powerful.
Mm.
We understand it very easy. And somebody that who wants to get into different level of the might, he can study.
I want to throw something in here straight away.
Do you know how you become simple? When you have the true knowledge, Brother Ejaz. Think about what I said.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't know a lot of stuff, you're trying to pretend, you get so complicated. Fallacies comes from here.
But you're talking about humbleness.
That's another subject. If you are simple, you are humble, and vice versa.
Exactly.
This is not two different aspects. Brother, let me tell you another expression.
Please.
It says, two persons are afraid of an empty gun. The one who is in front of the gun thinks he doesn't know. It's empty gun. He thinks
he's going to be
killed. He's going to be shot at. He's going to be killed.
Hmm.
And the one who even has his own finger on the trigger, he knows there is no bullet in it. If the guy in front of him, jumps on him, what is he going to do? Nothing. He has no bullets. So two persons are afraid of one empty gun. This is when you don't have the true knowledge.
Exactly.
Then you fear,
Quite.
You have no power.
Very, very eloquent.
That's why you become simple. That's why you become humble, when you have a true knowledge. And true knowledge comes from true
the true source.
True source. Remember, I didn't say true teacher, because we don't call God teacher.
No. The true source.
That's a different story.
Yeah. The truth.
Okay.
The truth. That's what
we're
talking
about. A true source is the most knowledge one, the most powerful one, the most wise one.
Yes.
I even shouldn't say the most, because when I use the word the most, it sounds like I'm comparing something with, you know, something else.
Sure.
But there is no way to comparison. Sure. The wise, the might, the knowledge one.
Yes.
So the real source.
These are the sifat you're talking
God,
about God.
Yeah,
the attributes, the names.
The names.
Yes.
Which actually is action,
yeah.
Which is power.
Yes.
When you're talking about God, you're not talking about the identity, the
no.
true sense of God. You can't do that.
No.
There's a tradition.
Hmm. Please quote it.
There's a tradition. It says, don't think about God, about the sense, the true sense of God. But if you want to get to know God, think about the benefits, or we call it ni'mah, the things that He gave us, which they become all. Every single moment they become sign of God, sign of His knowledge, His being, His power, and His mercy.
Don't
Imam was simple because of this, because he knew Quran.
Yeah.
If you get to know Quran, you become simple. You don't need to get complicated. You don't need to get sophisticated. Was
Dr. Hasni, thank you for that. For what you've said so far, in terms of the discussion of the personality of the Imam, the simplicity, the honesty. These beautiful values that take us towards Allah, because really what we are talking about at the end of the day.
Brother, the point is this. If we get to know Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, the way we're supposed to.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
We become a good follower.
Yeah.
We cannot go astray.
No matter what. No.
We always steadfast on the right track, doing the right thing. Of course, from A to B without any damage.
Well, the thing is that you come back to that legacy of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, who was not able to put that down in words, but the Imam certainly did, and we hopefully will discuss that at a later stage as well. And that is that he talked about two things. He talked about the two legacies that the Holy Prophet left. That was the Quran and his family, the Itrati. And that was a principle. Let's continue this discussion into the next program, and we're going to look at,
God willing, we are going to.
Yeah,
if we get a chance, we'll
look at other aspects of this simplicity,
exactly.
Honesty,
mm-hmm.
and the purity of intention. Mm-hmm. I want to go into this aspect.
Purity. That's a good subject,
yeah,
also.
Yeah.
God,
so let's do that into the next program. Thank you, listeners, for being on the for listening to us today. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And thank you for giving me a chance to do so.
No, that's all right, Doctor. You're welcome, Dr. Hasni. And may the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you, brother.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
Good afternoon.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan as a means to uphold the 2020 deal reached between former President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. But the withdrawal of American forces from the country meant that all U.S. allies had to follow suit, regardless of whether they intended to do so, as they depended on U.S. logistics and air support, as well as the safe evacuation of their citizens. The developments in recent weeks have reignited the debate about the formation of a European Rapid Response Force.
And I think it's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that the Afghanistan events of this summer is one of these cases.
The EU has been working on that. It was positioned for us, 4 years ago as, well, Trump is an unreliable ally. See what he's doing. He's driving the Europeans to do this. But as a matter of fact, that project was under construction before Trump.
In an interview earlier this year, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer questioned the bloc's strategic autonomy from the United States. Her comments drew fierce criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron, who believes in the bloc's so-called strategic autonomy.
You know, Europe, with its colonial history, it's certainly, not good news to find out that they're building a new army of their own again, because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do. And so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who it was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelan is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The United States has fully withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan to officially end 20 years of occupation. The invasion will be remembered for its colossal failures, unfulfilled promises, and a frantic final exit that cost the lives of scores of Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. military personnel. The final U.S. evacuation flight left Kabul Airport late on Monday. U.S. military officials say hundreds of Americans who have been left on Afghan soil will be transported out of the country in the coming days. A Taliban spokesman says the defeat of the United States in Afghanistan was a lesson for the invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
More than 122,000 people have reportedly been evacuated from Kabul since August the 14th, the day before the Taliban took control of the country. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under immense criticism of his handling of the withdrawal. Nearly 90 retired U.S. generals and admirals have called for Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley to resign for their roles surrounding the chaotic pullout. The retired flag officers proposed what they felt should have happened in the withdrawal, including not rushing the pullout and not abandoning the Bagram Air Base and American weapons and military equipment in the hands of the Taliban.
The war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again.
Well, I don't believe the U.S. government has learned a lesson. The U.S. media certainly hasn't learned a lesson. Statements we've seen from Biden, for instance, have been that we've accomplished our goals in Afghanistan, which I think is furthest from the truth.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks under the pretext of so-called war on terror. According to estimates, America's longest war took the lives of nearly 2,500 U.S. troops and an estimated 240,000 Afghans, and cost around $2 trillion U.S. dollars. Thousands of Afghan civilians were also maimed during the years. The estimated interest costs of the war are expected to top $6.5 trillion by 2050.
I think the U.S. went in there 20 years ago, removed the Taliban, and now the Taliban is back, perhaps stronger than ever. It seems like it's an utter defeat for the United States.
The war has left Afghanistan in ruins and devastated the country's infrastructure. Just as Saigon marked the humiliating defeat of U.S. geostrategic ambitions in Indochina after 10 years of war and conflict in Vietnam, many analysts now believe Kabul marks the same humiliating defeat in Central Asia.
You know, after the Vietnam War, there was something they called the Vietnam Syndrome. The American people didn't want to go into that kind of war ever again. And I believe we're seeing the beginning of an Afghan syndrome. The American people think it was a mistake, don't want to see it again. The trillions of dollars that went into Afghanistan could have been used to help the Afghani people or for the American people.
The botched military occupation is likely to trigger a refugee crisis in the Middle East and beyond. When it comes to Afghanistan and the wider region, Washington and its allies have proved after two decades that they have nothing to offer but misery and despair. U.S. officials believed that a U.S.-trained, funded, and equipped Afghan army could hold the line against the poorly trained, funded, and equipped Taliban insurgency. But after a 20-year presence in Afghanistan, they still had little or no understanding of Afghan society and the power of Taliban militants.
Hundreds of Palestinians have staged protests against the Israeli regime's inhumane blockade of the Gaza Strip, burning tires and hurling explosive devices toward the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories for several consecutive nights. The Israeli military, which deployed additional troops along the fence ahead of the night protests, used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades against Palestinian protesters. Several Palestinians have been injured by Israeli forces east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry's spokesman, Ashraf Al-Kedra, said several others were hurt from tear gas canisters fired at them. During Saturday night's protests alone, 11 Palestinians were injured by live fire and other aggressive measures used by Israeli forces.
I mean, it's because the laws are not being implemented, they're not being penalized, they're not being punished for all these, violations of all these laws. So they feel like they have a green light to commit more crimes and more crimes. And this becomes a natural system for the Zionists. The Zionists now, they think that they're above the law and no law is going to, stop them from committing any crime that they want to do. And that's why you can see that whenever we hear condemnations from countries or even the nation's assemblies, there's nothing really coming out of it at the end of the day.
Gazans have been organizing protests since last week. They are demanding that the crossings be reopened to facilitate the entry of goods and humanitarian aid. In a statement on Sunday, the resistance committees in Palestine announced that the protests will continue until the Israeli regime lifts its siege. The Palestinians say the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on the positions of the resistance in Gaza would not dissuade them from fighting for their freedom and dignity. Over the Israeli regime's tight blockade, which now includes deliberate hampering of efforts to reconstruct the strip following its latest war on Gaza. Back in May, the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days,
killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups fired around 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war, forcing Tel Aviv to call for a ceasefire.
The only way it really works with this particular regime, and this illegitimate regime, the Zionist regime, is by righteous, unified resistance. And that's exactly what we want to see in Palestine.
Amid the ongoing confrontations, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz met in Ramallah on Sunday, marking the highest level meeting held between the two sides in over a decade. The two discussed issues related to diplomacy, economics, and civil affairs, according to a statement from Gantz's office.
You know, it's quite clear that the Zionist regime does not want peace and does not want to recognize the Palestinians, because they had a chance many times. You can see that they're still stealing, you know, areas in the West Bank, and that's obviously international law breaches. We can see now, you know, Sheikh Jarrah, Sinwan, all these different areas, even in Jerusalem, in different areas, they're still, you know, evicting, stealing people's homes in a very, very barbaric way.
The Palestinian resistance groups have pledged not to allow the Israeli regime to continue its aggression against the Palestinian people or change the rules of engagement.
The Limelight.
There has been a rapid increase in the number of American children receiving COVID-19 diagnoses over the past month, a disturbing trend being witnessed across the country as kids head back to school. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Child COVID Diagnosis Surpass 500,000 Just As Schools Start Reopening. Stay tuned for more. There has been a rapid increase in the number of American children receiving COVID-19 diagnoses over the past month, a disturbing trend being witnessed across the country as kids head back to school. The American Academy of Pediatrics reported that between August 5th to 26th, more than 500,000 children received a positive diagnosis of coronavirus. That's a significant rise compared to months prior. Indeed, for the single week of August 19th, there were over 203,000 positive tests identified among children, a substantially higher number than the 8,500 cases reported during an earlier one-week study done in June. The alarming trend has health experts worried, and many are renewing calls for school districts to require masks for children, especially for those who are under the age of 12, as they are as yet ineligible for the vaccinations to protect against COVID. The virus is raging in all of these children who are unvaccinated, which is why in schools, mask mandates are so important. They have no other protection, said CNN medical analyst Jonathan Rayner, adding, they're literally sitting ducks. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has recommended that every school district in the country implement masking and social distancing standards within school buildings to prevent the virus from spreading. A number of districts across the U.S. have instituted such rules, but many have not. And a number of states with Republican governors have actually banned districts from being able to do so even if they want to. The situation is becoming dire for children in many of those states, particularly because this round of COVID, which includes the Delta variant of the virus, seems to be affecting children more than it did a year ago. In Texas, several hospitals have reported that they have zero pediatric ICU hospital beds available because of the spike in COVID infections among children. Florida is facing similar challenges, and as a result of increases in COVID numbers, at least two school districts have already had to close their doors until next week. As the number of coronavirus diagnoses among children increases, more evidence about the efficacy of masks to prevent its spread is becoming available. A randomized controlled study in Bangladesh, for instance, found a 9.3% reduction of coronavirus diagnoses when just 7 in 25 individuals in the study were masking up. That, on its own, is an encouraging statistic, but the effectiveness of masking would be many times greater if it were near universal, one of the study's authors said. I think this should basically end any scientific debate about whether masks can be effective in combating COVID at a population level. Jason Abalak, an economist at Yale University who was involved in the study, told the Washington Post. However, in spite of the recent studies and others like it showing near definitive proof that masking is an effective way to prevent the spread of coronavirus, proponents of state mask mandate bans are digging their heels in, insisting that they have a right to ban such rules from being enforced at a local level. Florida Education Department Commissioner Richard Crocan, discussing a lawsuit brought by parents against the state's mask mandate ban, said his department would appeal the decision in the near future. Karakhan said to Fox News, "I'm very confident they are going to rule on our side because what we are doing is absolutely within the Constitution, within the law." Yet, in a ruling to which Karakhan is referring to, Leon County Circuit Judge John Cooper said, "The school districts were following the law as their actions didn't infringe on the fundamental rights of a parent, as the legislation states. The law, which was enacted in June with Governor Ron DeSantis' signature, says that districts cannot make decisions for students that affect their upbringing, education, healthcare choices, and mental health without demonstrating that such action is reasonable and necessary to achieve a compelling state interest." In making his ruling recently, Cooper noted that the state failed to show how masking rules were unreasonable, while pointing out that the ban was violating the same parents' Bill of Rights that it was aiming to enforce. Cooper said, "My ruling in this case, if you want to put it in one sentence, is I am enforcing the bill passed by the legislature and requiring that anyone who uses that bill to follow all provisions and not part of the provisions."
IRIB English Radio.